On this week's Big Tech Show, how will the latest developments in artificial intelligence affect your life? Will you get new powerful personal assistants? Are you in danger of something terrible happening? We explain what's going on.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Anthropic, which is OpenAI competitor, their startup lab, actually founded by former OpenAI employees, they actually eclipsed GPT-4 only just a couple of weeks ago with their latest model, and the internet went crazy. This is just better than GPT-4 at everything. So OpenAI had to respond to that.
The Big Tech Show, available on all podcast platforms.
This is an Irish Independent podcast.
Hello and welcome to Real Health with me, Carl Henry. Families are messy and complicated and can be difficult to navigate when you're an adult. But growing up, how did your childhood experiences shape who you are now? And if there are some hang-ups that are holding you back, can they be overcome? This week, I am delighted to be joined by psychotherapist Richard Hogan, whose new book, Home is Where the Start Is, looks at how your family shaped who you are and how understanding your unique experience can help you become the best version of yourself. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carl. Good to be here.
I didn't realise you were from Cork. We were chatting before we came on air, and you're actually from very near where we live, where we moved to in West Cork. It's a small world.
It's a very small world.
The book is out in 2 weeks. It's already rocking up the charts.
It is. It's number two in the bestsellers currently, which I'm actually kind of overwhelmed by the response to it and the amount of messages that I've been receiving, because I've been thinking just before I came out, thinking, why did I embed myself into this narrative? I could have written a nice book around theory without putting my own story in there. But actually, the feedback I've been getting and the messages from people and the emails and actually letters into my clinic from people who said, that's my experience growing up, because alcohol is a huge problem in this country. Mm-hmm. And so I speak about growing up with alcoholism present in the family. And I heard a lot this week, in the last 2 weeks, from children who grew up with parents who were addicts. And I suppose that's what maybe kind of put myself into it. And I suppose I felt over the last 2 weeks, I'm glad I did now. Yeah. I raised maybe that, articulate an experience that a lot of us don't speak about.
And do you think the fact that it's sold so well already shows that we've a nation out there who are suffering?
Well, we all come out of families.
Yeah, we do.
You know, and I think the book is tapping into, like, you know, well, what was your family like? I mean, it really clearly describes all the different types of families, the early attachments that you have with your primary caregiver, what they can do to you. Because I suppose, Carl, working clinically, what I see is people come in and they say to me, I don't know why I do that. I don't know why that's my default response. I don't know why when I get into a conflict, that's how I am. I don't understand. I'd hear women say, why I pick this type of partner all the time. I don't know why, you know, that question, I don't know why. Yeah. And the book is trying to really unpack that and show us, well, here's the whys. Here are the potential whys. And if you understand that bit, you know, you can change how you think, you can change how you behave, and ultimately you can start bringing, as I did, a bit of joy into your life. And that's why my story is in there, to show that I'm actually the theory in practice. I did this stuff myself, and I changed the course and trajectory of my own life. And if I can do it, anyone can do it.
You mentioned it several times. Yeah. Let's start there. Yeah. In terms of, tell us a little bit about your background. I know it's in the book, but, you know, for people listening in, tell them a little bit more about it.
In a very loving family, very fun family. But there was addiction present in the family. So there was that uncertainty all the time. There was that chaos at times and dysfunction in the family at times. And then it all functioned so normally and so well, and fun and singing and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, then this was a present in our family, and it caused huge problems. It caused huge problems for me growing up in that uncertainty and never knowing what you're going to get in the morning, never knowing what's going to be there in the evening. So there's that sense of, you know, just never really having anything that's really solid or secure. And that really damaged, I think, my thinking as a teenager. You know, and I think that's the lived experience. And I hear it in my clinic of a lot of people who grew up with addiction in the family, that sense of uncertainty, that sense of never having a solid ground, you know, worried about bringing people into the house, worried about girlfriends coming in when you're a teenager, all that kind of stuff, because at any moment it can be something completely different.
Okay, so our childhood and our experiences, they really do shape.
They do, yeah. But here's the good...
Not permanently.
They really... And where we come in the family, for the first, the second, the third, all those things are really important. Also, our attachment to our primary caregiver is hugely significant. That develops how we talk to ourselves. you know, that develops the voice that's in there. You know, I meet clients and they say to me, I'm no good. I'm not that, no, you know, nothing ever good happens in my life. And I'm not just, nobody likes me. Like, you weren't born thinking those things, but the family maybe and the environment that you existed in, the ecology that you existed in gave you some really negative feedback here. How about we figure out what that ecology, that system was, unpack it. And now here's the really important part, move past it. Right, and I think sometimes psychotherapy can get you caught in the trauma there and not help you out of it. And that's a key thing that the book is trying to do is here's a roadmap out of it. Here's some ideas that you might help you to think a bit differently. Here's what you possibly might think and here's how you can think differently.
Okay, and that's important to remind people that there is a way out
absolutely.
Of it. Absolutely. And you can, with work, work your way through it.
Like change, we're never one thing for too long. And what Carl Jung says, you know, one of the great psychologists, you're not what happened to you, you're who you choose to become. And that becoming is the most remarkable journey any of us go on. And at times it can be tainted and corrupted by a lot of the stuff that we navigate going through schools, going through our family, going through our relationships.
But families are, like, there's no normal family.
No, there's not.
That's important to remember because, yeah. You know, that sense of normal, I don't think it is. I think we all think it exists, but it actually doesn't.
No.
They are complicated and they are messy. And, like, every family will have stuff.
Well,
it'd be weird if it didn't.
You know, I'm a systems trained psychotherapist. Yeah. It's the most complicated system you're ever going to navigate, and you'll be navigating it for the rest of your life, is the family system. And it has a thing called homeostasis, balance. An equilibrium. And so wherever you come in the system and how your parents thought about you and spoke about you, that's all about keeping the balance and maintaining mm-hmm. the balance. You know, when you go back into your family, Carl, at Christmas, you're immediately dragged back absolutely. Into that position that you were as a child and your parents have you labeled as that and that's who you are. And the minute mm-hmm. you start to step outside that, they kind of go back into your role because that helps us make sense of the complexity of this whole system. And that's what happens with families. You get labeled. It's not out of malice, but it's out of like reducing the complexity and making it much easier for the family to understand. You know,
it's very much a parent's way of dealing with exactly, it, is that the child is shy, bold, fun, happy, whatever.
They're the responsible one, they're the wild one, they're the academic one, they're the sporty one. And so you get reduced, you know, right down into this description.
For parents listening in who are starting to feel guilty, it is important to remind them too that that's quite normal too.
No, absolutely. It's about reducing complexity.
Yes.
And what I'd say to parents always is that labels don't predict the future, they write them. And so if you want to introduce change in how your child behaves, speak about them differently when they're just out of earshot.
Because you know, they hear everything.
They hear absolutely everything. You think they're not listening and you're talking to your brother going, oh God, that Carl is so wild. He's whatever. If you want to change how they perceive themselves and start to behave, I would say talk about them differently and watch them live up to the label that you give them.
Talk to me about intergenerational patterns and how they can help you when you get a grasp of what they are.
Yeah, well, what I do and what I clearly describe in the book is the genogram. And often when I'm working, I'll start off with the genogram, which is a visual representation of your family. So it's like a family tree, but it's looking at beliefs and values. It's not a static thing. It's constantly moving. And so what is remarkable, Karen, when I'm doing this work with people, they'd say, my God, I never realized my grandfather struggled with addiction. My father struggled with addiction. I'm struggling with addiction. Or, you know, my grandmother got pregnant early in her life. My mother got pregnant early in life. I got pregnant early in my life. There's patterns that exist in family systems. And often we walk into let's say we go into college and we meet someone at the college bar and we go off into this romantic life and we have children. And we don't think, I wonder, you know, are all these patterns present now? And what was some of the legacies that were handed down to me as a, you know, what did I see my parents model for me in their relationship? What am I going to bring into my relationship here? And how am I going to parent my kids? And it's such a complicated, dense thing. And children expect their parents to be perfect. You know, they just expect them to be absolutely perfect. And that's an unrealistic expectation. And so we're all, as you said, parents, families, people are messy. Families are very messy. And so we bring all this mess together and then we try to coherently parent someone. And it's not often a very coherent endeavor. And so children can when you look at your intergenerational patterns that are evident in your family, you can start to see, God, yeah, I'm not a prisoner to that stuff. It exists in the family. For me, when I looked at it, I was like, well, that's it. I'm not going to be drinking heavily. I'm not going to be an addict. I'm going to watch that because it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And I could easily live into it. And I drank heavily enough in my 20s. And I could easily got into that life. And I was like, well, no, I'm going to end that historically negative thing pattern that's in the family.
And was there a point in your 20s where you made that?
Yeah.
Because that can happen for people, can't it? Like we would see it for people who want to get fit, get healthy,
lose weight.
There can be a point or an axis where something kind of forces them to make the
decision? Yeah, it's a good question. And I didn't really talk about my family at all. You know, my girlfriend, who's my wife now for 20 years, I didn't speak about my life at all really growing up, you know, because it was something that was troubling me and I didn't know how to express it, and it was confusing and all that kind of stuff and painful. It wasn't until we sat down one evening and we were kind of talking about having kids and all that, I was like, you know, I need to address this stuff. I need to look at this stuff and really start going back into it and analysing it and trying to figure out, because I don't want to bring any of that stuff into my life. You know, that's a really negative thing to bring into your life, and I wanted to thrive in my life, and I wanted my children never to look at the car and think, oh shit, dad's home. I felt that, you know. I never wanted my kids to think that was, you know, that when they saw the car that it was a negative thing, or when they saw me at the door it was I wanted them to kind of like, you know, have a nice life and enjoy. And ultimately, what a loss it would be for me to miss out on that joy, because that's the greatest joy I have in my life, is being with my children, you know, and being at home and watching, you know, silly programs like A Dog's Journey. It's now my favourite. It's now surpassed The Godfather as the most important movie in my life.
You make parenting sound idyllic, and I'm aware of the parents who are listening in thinking, oh man, I'm going home to two kids now who are wild, bouncing around the house. I don't have that, you know, that they struggle with. And that's normal too.
Absolutely. And I feel for parents. Yeah. I think parents, it's a tougher job than it's ever been. And parents thinking, now on top of everything else, I have to be a psychologist, a clinical psychologist, a psychotherapist, a counsellor and a psychiatrist, and then build my child's resilience. So it's kind of like, and then work two jobs, you know, and all the things that we're doing. So there's incredible pressure on parents. And I think on mothers particularly, because I think what can happen to moms is that they look at their own mother and think, God, she was with me a lot more. And they get really guilty. And then they parent from that position of guilt, and it causes all sorts of problems. You acquiesce, you give in to the child, you give them everything they want, and then you've got a child who's got lots of expectations and difficult to manage in adolescence and all that. And so that's what the kind of what I'm trying to do in the book is like a roadmap to that, where you kind of watch all that stuff and understand the importance of how you were parented and how you're going to parent. But it's not essentially a parenting book. It's a book for all of us who come out of a family and want to think about maybe beginning to thrive in their lives and think differently about themselves, and to unpack some of the voice that's in there that might be self-limiting and restricting and holding you back, because we all have it. It's a bit of just being a Homo sapien, the negative.
And the key thing from just listening to you there is that it's that ability to talk your way out of it. That you have people in relationships all around the country who are listening in who would never have that chat with a partner. The way you did that reflective piece of saying, well, I need to sort, you know, that chat's really important, as almost in a therapeutic way, isn't it? To talk about your past, talk about your experiences. Yeah. You got to get it out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sharing it with a partner
is very powerful.
A sibling or a friend or whatever is really crucial.
I actually really found, having written the book, and I'm a psychotherapist, and you know, I do a lot of, you know, self-analysis and all that, I found it was really cathartic. And the response that people, you know, that I've received has been really cathartic. And I feel like, oh, there's actually, and I just know it anyway, you know, just being a human being, speaking about our lived experience is important. But also understanding that we're not a victim to things. You know, that I don't see myself as a victim to this childhood. And there was great moments in my childhood too. And that I can celebrate those great moments, and I can understand the negative moments. And I'm not that. That was a part of my childhood, and that's shaped who I am. But I also am something else besides that. And that's a really empowering thing, that you can say, I've had this negative experience in some ways, but I'm actually able to move beyond it. And I have stopped that legacy, say, of alcohol or addiction. And so my kids will never know what it's like to go down to the pub and the barman know my name, you know, and all that kind of stuff. They won't ever experience that. And so that you're never a prisoner to things. That's what I'm trying to say there, that you can always move beyond what's in the family, historically speaking.
And those early kind of beliefs, presumably they will in some way, shape or form always stay with you to a greater or lesser extent.
Yeah, well, you can work them out.
Yeah.
So we have 60 to 70,000 thoughts a day, and 90% of those are what we thought yesterday. So, like, you know, we're constantly thinking the same thing. We're thinking in patterns, because the brain has got an incredibly difficult job to do. I mean, the complicated computations of me sitting here and trying to understand exactly what's going on here, it's filtering out all this room. I haven't noticed that bag, for example, until now I've looked around. So your brain is constantly filtering out stuff, and it's filtering out, at times it can filter out good things for you, Carl. And so you can become primed to only see negative. And that's what I'd see in my clinic. People would say to me, you know, nothing good ever happens to me. And you just unpack that, and you figure out where that voice, that corruption crept in, and then how to kind of rewire your thinking. And that's kind of what's really important here. We can always think more positively. We can always move beyond negative patterns. I mean, it's neuroscience, which is say that when you think billions of neurons connect, the neural growth factor knits around that. That's a thought. Then I look for confirmation bias. Let's say I think I'm stupid, and then I go into your class, you're a teacher, and you give me like an F and say, Richard Hogan, you're so stupid, the 80s Ireland, right? That becomes a pathway, which means it's the only thought now available to me. And so when I think about myself, I think I'm stupid. I'm not that bright. I'm not that clever.
Self-fulfilling.
Yeah, and then you fulfill that prophecy. You know, and I work a lot with teachers and all that, and they said, this guy's really difficult in the class. I said, well, if you talked about him differently, watch what might happen there. And so there's a lot of self-fulfilling prophecies that go on.
The talking thing is a fascinating angle on it, which is change how you speak about the person when the person's around.
Yeah, absolutely. Think about change how you speak to yourself. The most important relationship you'll ever have is that relationship up here. It's the longest relationship you'll ever have in your life. And how is that voice? Is it supportive? Is it like championing you on and saying, you know, I think you're pretty great here. You've got a lot of talent here. Or is it saying, I sit with it all day long in the clinic and I hear incredible people. And I'd say to them, would you say that to me? And they'd say, no, Jesus, I would never say that to you. And I'd say, why not? And they'd say, I like you. I'd say, should you not like yourself? Mm. Isn't that not the most important thing to do here? Is like yourself fundamentally first.
And that's not that big American, you know, looking for some mirror. Hey, you're great.
No, this is actually seeing yourself. Yes. This is actually because the mirror is tainted by all the stuff that you've experienced. And so when you come to see yourself in the mirror, it's not honestly reflected back. It's tainted through all the stuff, the labels, all your position in the family, your attachments, all of that stuff taints what was said to you in school. School is a massive system for labeling you. And so when you look at yourself, all those labels are there. And it's like what I'm saying is, imagine what it would be like to look at yourself unfiltered from those labels and that kind of corruption in your thinking. Then you'd see yourself as you truly are, right? An incredible gift. I mean, the chances of us being alive here, Carl, are 400 quadrillion to the power of 150,000. In betting terms, almost zero. And so we often give away that gift. That's a miracle. That is absolutely a miracle. Life is a miracle. And so we often give that a miracle away because we become tainted and all the stuff that's around us and all. I'm not that good. I'm not that clever. This is what I hear in the corporate space all the time by massive, massive people. I'll get found out. You know, people will know I'm not that clever.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
You know, the whole
imposter syndrome.
Yeah. I think we all have a little bit of that going around because as Homo sapiens, it's probably better and beneficial for your survival to think the noise over there in the woods is bad rather than thinking, oh, it must be good. I'll go over and investigate that. So we're primed to kind of see negativity.
Chat to me about your personality trait then. That's something that we should all know.
We should all know our personality. The big five.
Okay.
Openness.
Yeah.
Extroversion. Agreeableness. Yep. Conscientiousness. And neuroticism.
Okay.
And two of those are, neuroscience would say, if you got two high levels of these, would increase your chances of being happy. And so openness and extroversion. So if you're open to things.
Yeah.
And you're interested in new ideas, neuroscience would say. And if you get energy from connecting with people, because we're Homo sapiens, we're mammals, we're designed to connect as lockdown.
Which is why social networking is so important, not in the Facebook way, but actually in terms of meeting people.
Absolutely.
It's so important with the aging process to keep you healthy.
I mean, immediately when I met you, I listened to my brain a lot and it was going confirmation, in-out bias, kind of like, you know, do I know this kind of guy? I knew as I was sitting here, my brain was going, filtering out and kind of going, yeah, I can. And then you said about Cork, it went into an in-bias. I like this guy. He's someone
Cork
I can relate to.
Like other Cork people.
Yeah, but no,
I'm now half Cork.
Without consciously thinking it, your brain is doing that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're always doing that. And so being open and being extroverted is really helpful to kind of like, you know, feeling connected to other people. Conscientiousness, you know, on a high level can lead to perfectionism, right? Which a lot of lawyers would struggle with. They're very conscientious because the job they do, they have to be conscientious. But sometimes it can be overly conscientious and they can worry. And this is a thing that I'd often say to people who are conscientious is that they often worry because they believe that worry brings about a favorable outcome. If I'm not worrying...
Doctors are like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Anybody who's at a high level, they think, you know, if I'm not worrying, I can get blindsided. Mm-hmm. I can get whacked by life. And so what I'd explain to them that doesn't change the future outcome of any potential event. It only ruins your present. And so you can live with less worry in your life and not get whacked by life. You know what I mean? And so people would say neuroticism would be constantly... their moods will be in flux because they listen and they take what people say about them, you know, to heart. Mm-hmm. And so they're constantly, their well-being is hooked to an external force, and that can cause loads of problems. And agreeableness, I would say, for women is a problem in their 40s. They get labelled very early in childhood, and I see it. I've got three daughters myself, and I can see what the eldest, if there's an eldest daughter listening to this who's a mother now, you got labelled probably very young as the good daughter.
Of course.
You know, and then you were the good sister.
Yep.
And then you were the great wife, and now you're the great mother. And now you're going back to the great mother again, the daughter again, because your parents are elderly, and now mm-hmm. you're taking on all that role again. So that's an unsustainable pressure to be under, and you develop this paradigm. And I'd say to I work with a lot with women around this, and I'd say, what's the biggest fear there? If you said no, and they're like, that someone would say that I'm not helpful. Mm-hmm. So you can see the paradigm. I'm only valuable when I'm in service to people. And I try to free them from that paradigm, because that's a really restricting paradigm. And 47.2 is our most unhappy year as a Homo sapien, as a human.
47.2. Okay, yeah. Right.
I'm 47.3 now, so I'm just moving past it.
But here, I'm 41, half a while
ago. You're grand about it. But there's some traps there to watch out for. And I'd say for men, it's like, you know, losing connection with your friends, because you get so consumed with your career, family and career and all that, and you lose contact. And I think in an Irish context, we're very bad at holding on to our friends. You know, we lose them in the drive for a career, and by the mid 40s we're kind of going, a career should be this, this, mm-hmm. this, and you get focused on it. But actually, when you look around, you've no connection. And for women, obviously there's a biological, the menopause, but also that sustain, that agreeableness, that trait agreeableness can be really problematic there, that makes you feel that you have to be in service to people to be valuable. And I'd say work at that one, because that's only ever going to make you a people pleaser, and that is someone who pleases nobody, least of all themselves.
Final question. Parents listening in then, who are probably struggling, I would imagine, a little bit. We've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, we had this lot in there.
in the space of 20 minutes. But they're going to wonder how they're going to parent their child without messing them up, basically. Or, you know, and presumably that's kind of impossible. That they're just going to do their best, and sometimes they'll nail it and sometimes they won't. And sometimes they'll lose the plot and shout and scream. And,
Carol, that is good enough. I'm a parent of three daughters. I get it right sometimes. I get it wrong sometimes. I try to minimize the errors, and I try to minimize the severity of the errors. But that's, you know, it's okay to be okay. It's okay to be okay at your parenting from time to time. And that's good enough. And I think parents give themselves a terrible time that they have to be this incredibly perfect thing all the time. You're tired. You're working hard. You're hungry. I mean, that's all part of your children also learning that people have mm-hmm. bad moments. You know what I mean? I think parents have the unrealistic expectation that they must be perfect all the time for their children, so the children see this perfect thing. That's not life. When they go off into the working world, they have to navigate, people's moods are low, and they have to navigate difficult people, and then they have to navigate people who don't treat them so well. And so at times, you know, you have to relax about how you're parenting your kids. It's not a game of perfect, and you won't be perfect. I'm not perfect. My kids say to me sometimes, you're supposed to be the family therapist, when I'm shouting up the stairs and I'm going, turn off the lights or whatever. You know what I mean? And that's good enough.
That's the best way to end this podcast, because you've got to reassure everyone out there who listens in that even the guy who's telling us what to do, he shouts up the stairs sometimes. Yeah. And that's absolutely crucial. The very best of luck with the book,
Thank
Richard.
You very much,
Home is Where the Start Is, Richard Hogan. It's out in all good bookstores and online now. It's been great to have you
Thank
in.
You,
I think we'll definitely get you in again
sure.
at some stage in the future if you come in and join us. Folks, I really hope you enjoyed today's episode. You know where we are, at Carl Henry PT on Instagram, realhealth at independent.ie. A fascinating episode. Really hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you next week. Slán go fóill.